Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Steve Holcomb. Steve, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right, so if we do a bit of an intro, and Theo's here as well, so Theo, say hello.
Hello.
Hiya, Theo.
Right, so we've got loads of questions, but obviously it's quite timely because you've just finished the Finland round of the Enduro GP. So do you want to give us a bit of a background about you, and then we're going to how you've got on this previous weekend.
So I basically started riding a bike like most kind of professionals, at least at quite a young age. I'd say around 3 or 4 years old, riding a PW50, kind of rode motocross schoolboys. So kind of up until I would say 11 or 12 years old, and then basically progressed into enduro, and basically worked my way from the bottom to the top, effectively. So started racing British Championship when I was 16 at kind of like the lowest class, and just gradually each year progressed up through, and eventually turned pro in 2016, and ended up going on to win 7 world championships, and I'm now where I am.
Amazing. So obviously turning pro, obviously, can you, because Theo was asking about that, because he said obviously about your bike, and I said, well, I assume Steve gets that from data themselves, obviously being a pro. So Theo basically wants to know all about the sponsorship side of things.
So I would say being like turning pro, and basically to me what that meant is I eventually got a salary basically to ride bikes. So I was able to stop working. Or like normal work, as what most people would say. So so like during 2015, I did race most of the rounds of the Junior World Championship, but I was still kind of flying back after races and kind of working, being a gardener and kind of looking after Christmas tree farms. But turning pro in 2016 basically meant that I could stop that and focus solely on racing.
Yeah, and so how did that come about? Was it just from obviously a great run of results and just being consistent?
Yes. So that basically was results led. I ended up having quite a good season in 2015 in the junior class, and caught kind of a few teams were after my services, as it were, and kind of settled on signing for the Beta Factory team, which I'm still with now.
And did they, I mean, how does that come about? Do they approach you, or do you sort of go to them? Or I suppose when you're turning pros, people sort of looking to sign you?
Yes. I would say kind of that, that was definitely, they approached me. Like I say, I was still kind of fresh in that kind of scene at that time. So they kind of approached me. I was riding a beta at the time, for kind of a satellite team that were running in 2015, and so basically when the factory team came knocking, I was more than happy to sign for them.
I bet. Obviously, can you just explain what a satellite team is to Theo, because he probably won't be familiar with that term?
So like in the World Championship, you have like the factories will have kind of their main team, so that's like a direct support from the factory, so they're calling the shots and kind of they say what is on the bike, and then most manufacturers will have kind of satellite teams, so teams that will effectively be like perhaps like a little tier down, but still have some factory support, but they're more free to choose what they want on the bikes, whereas what we have is basically what the standard bike from the factory comes as, and that's kind of our base, and that's kind of the main team from each manufacturer.
Right, got you. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. Theo's got probably at least 10 questions here. Yeah. He's keen to rattle them off. I think before we do, if we can just cover a bit of your weekend at Finland, obviously, are you still there now?
I'm actually in Sweden now.
Ready for the next round.
Finland. Yeah. So we stayed in Finland at the race last night, and then took a plane this morning to Sweden. And got here kind of early afternoon, and have just been trying to recover a little bit ahead of going test walking tomorrow. So,
How does the recovery? I was going to say, how does the recovery thing look? I mean, I've watched some of the clips, and it looks pretty savage and sort of hard on the body.
Yeah, the relatively long races. We were quite fortunate, really, in Finland. It was a relatively short race in terms of like time. Usually, we can ride upwards of 7.5. kind of 7 hours, 45 minutes.
Wow.
Whereas Finland was just shy of 6 hours,
right.
But arguably as physical as a 7.5 hour day, just in how challenging the track was. So, right. Yeah, today's been trying to eat as good and kind of do as little as I can, really. And then we've got the unfortunate thing that the Sweden round this weekend's a Friday Saturday race as opposed to a Saturday Sunday race. So we kind of so trying to like I say, recover the best I can ahead of test walking tomorrow.
Yeah, and what does that test walk involve? Is it just sort of going over the conditions or seeing the layout, or does the layout sort of vary from year to year?
Yeah. So although we raced here in 2021, we've been told that the tests are in completely different places. So, basically, there's other than a few bits of information you could get from 2021 in terms of how maybe the ground develops to help you kind of tire choice wise. But so we basically can walk the stages that we're timed on from 3 days before the event. So we do upwards of 20, 30 kilometers worth of walking before the races actually start. So that's pretty much all we do on the 3 days before the race.
And I suppose you're constantly checking the weather as well, because that can massively affect things, can it?
Yeah, it sure can. Luckily here for this weekend, it's looking like it's going to be kind of low 20s. So that kind of makes things a little bit more easier. Whereas in Finland, we had quite heavy rain up until the start of kind of like the super test, which is like our prologue on the Friday evening.
Right.
And luckily it was dry for that. And then Saturday, it basically started a little bit damp and basically got drier throughout the whole weekend.
And with that, sort of, is that like a tricky set of track conditions with it sort of changing and drying?
Yes, it is. Because especially because kind of like the way the Enduro GPs work, the top riders start first. So we've got it lucky from the point of view where what we walk is how our first special tests look. But then when we come around on lap two, there's been, close to 200 riders pass through. So there's quite a change in the terrain. So it's all about trying to manage that and kind of predict what how the tests are going to deteriorate. Some races are much more difficult from that point of view, because if you're on soft ground, it obviously deteriorates a lot more than if you're on hard ground. It's all trying to, that's the art of basically what we race, is trying to predict what's going to happen.
If we let Theo answer a few, or ask a few questions, because he's got them lined up and he's itching to ask him. So go on, mate, shoot. Ask those to Steve in whichever order you want.
So obviously we know how you're like super, super pro at Enduro.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you have any top tips for newbie starts.
I would say definitely enjoy it. I think with anything that you do, if you enjoy it, you'll naturally be more excited to do it and to keep doing it. I would say that's a massive thing. Even turning pro for me is when it starts becoming a job, it starts, in one respect, you start to take the fun out of it. I'd say work hard. That's definitely a big one, especially if you're looking to keep developing and progressing. And like anything in life, it's, you have a lot of highs and lows, and it's important just to have a goal and kind of work towards what you want out of racing.
Brilliant. That's a good answer. Yeah. And again, same, I think Alex said something a bit similar, didn't he, as our first guest. Yeah. Working hard and not giving up.
Yeah,
go on. Thea's got another one for you. Yeah, go on.
So, we know you've been doing dirt biking for a very, very long time now. And we were wondering, what's your best, worst crash?
Oh, I've been unfortunate to have quite a few bad crashes. I'm not particularly known for my crashes, but certainly the last two years, I've seen a fair share of the floor. Which is never good. It's tricky. I'd had a couple of big crashes when I was kind of a kid. But as far as being a pro, nothing. I've had a few like where I've kind of tried to jump some ditches and kind of like the bike's reacted in a strange way and kind of kicked off to the side. And then you do a thing called like a where it fishtails, where it basically because you load the rear of the bike so much, it kind of ends up swapping. So you're like fishtailing down the track and end up cartwheeling, which is never good. But then most recently, my crash where I had a shoulder operation over the winter, and that was caused from probably one of the kind of slowest crashes I've had. You know, mm-hmm. I just washed the front at a kind of event for the manufacturer I ride for at the end of the year last year, and put my arm out awkwardly and dislocated my shoulder. So yeah, it goes to show you can have, you know, one of the biggest crashes of your life and kind of get up and walk away and then have a strange crash and put your arm out awkwardly and you know, do more damage. So
was it those ones as well that sort of didn't look that bad when it happened? Yeah, it wasn't spectacular, but it's caused the most damage.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think I've got another question as well.
So
from your worst crashes and stuff, do you have like any funny stories from when you were on your dirt bike going to events like these?
I think it's generally always good having kind of mates around. I know you mentioned Alex earlier. He's actually sat next to me because he came over to support me in Finland, and he's kind of come with me for the trip to Sweden. So yeah, I have a lot of good stories with Alex. Rather not share. It's hard to put a finger kind of on one particular moment, but it's tricky.
Right,
I'd say just kind of generally, you know, with your mates and enjoying traveling around Europe, you know, going to places where people don't speak the language and you're trying to get by, and you know, just small mundane things, like you go into the supermarket and you end up buying sparkling water and just like random things like that. It's just, you know, part of being in Europe and being in countries where, you don't speak the lingo.
Now, one question you were going to ask earlier, which about how you get your kit from one place to another in different countries. That was one, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. So, because you're traveling through different countries, so you're in Sweden now, but you were in Finland earlier, do you get your bikes and like all your kit traveled to the different country?
So one of the big perks of being professional is the team obviously take like a big truck to the races, so our race bikes and kind of spare parts and everything travel with them, so they bring that to the races and I'm able to put basically all of my riding gear in with the truck. So that basically turns up to the races, but I also, to the majority of the races in the season, take a motorhome, which is kind of from my side, it takes the guesswork out of traveling, because sometimes you can stay in a good hotel, whereas other times you stay in a bad hotel, and the motorhome basically just brings me consistency to the race meetings. And I'm always at the track, because sometimes you could have a hotel that's 5 minutes down the road, sometimes it could be 25 minutes. So it's kind of all about being a bit more consistent with my planning.
Always got the stuff in.
So it's always got wet weather gear. It's got, you know, because we can use different goggles when it's wet with like a roll off film, as opposed to just like a clear lens on the goggle. So I've usually got, you know, 101 things in the camper for any occasion. So it always helps when that's at the race.
Brilliant. What about that one? Next, your first question for you.
So you've been doing this for a while, like I've just repeated. And obviously you're going to need kit for doing your races. Do you have any kit that you can't live without?
I would say, besides like the main things, I would say I wouldn't like to ride without a, like, my helmet. I would say that would be something that's a particular kind of no-no for me. I think a lot of the other kit you can kind of manage. I'd say knee braces are a big one. And also, like, I like to basically track everything I do. So wearing my watch, which monitors like my heart rate, and kind of that is a big part of my training program. So I would say those are the three particular things that I would say I definitely can't live without. And it's hard for me to pick exactly one of them, but yeah, probably helmets, probably the top of that list. That's definitely something that I can't live without is my own helmet.
Are you sort of quite brand loyal as well with stuff like that? When you get one, it's sort of, you get, you tend to stick with them.
Yes, very much so. I so since I turned pro, so this is my eighth season, I've stayed with all my companies basically for that whole time, apart from this year where I've changed boot company. Right. So yeah, I do like to stay loyal to the brands, and yeah, it's definitely worked out for me so far.
I've got a question I just thought of, actually, that is not on our list, but so obviously, you know, like when somebody else drives your car, you sort of know they've driven it. So if you were to say jump on Brad's bike, how different would that feel to you? Say if you jumped on his one after yours, like the first and second round, how would it be completely alien? Would you still be pretty quick on his bike? Would it be like a completely different setup?
Yeah, they are very different bikes. Main reason, because they're basically like different engine characteristics. So the two-stroke engine as opposed to the four-stroke engine is like arguably two other ends of the spectrum. Four-stroke engines are usually very good at having torque and traction, but are generally harder to move, so they're less agile, whereas two-strokes generally have as well good torque but are a little bit more lively and lighter to move. So they would be, it would be quite a jump to kind of jump onto to Brad's bike as opposed to kind of my bike. But then I have ridden that bike for the first kind of 4 years of my career. I was on a 300 two-stroke and had a lot of success on one. And then, so yeah, it would be, I think I would be nigh on the same speed, if not a little bit quicker, if I were to go back on that bike. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, like you mentioned in that, and kind of apart, like the basis of the bike in terms of like the geometry of everything would be the same, but the bike would be completely different feeling. Because they're, like I say, they have so many more different characteristics.
How much sort of power do they put out? What's the sort of power and the torque figures of each of them?
Torque figures, I'm not sure. I mean, horsepower, probably mid 40s, high 40s, I would say, which is certainly a little bit less than what you would get from like a motocross bike. But we have to ride over such a bigger variation of terrain. We can't afford to kind of change bikes for each round, because we don't know what the rounds are going to be like until we're kind of at them. So yeah, it's all about kind of having the most power with it being as rideable as it can be.
Like a compromise, so
it's, it's always a compromise. And that's the same with suspension setup. You know, you need something that's going to work everywhere. But sometimes you need to compromise in the, you know, the higher and lower ends of that variability.
And would you, do you have sort of different, so we're obviously complete newbies, do you have completely different suspension setups for each round?
No, we, so most suspension has quite a lot of adjustment. So we basically spend a lot of time at the beginning of the year trying adjusting things internally to get kind of a feeling that you're happy with, and then try to keep that system the same for the whole year, so the bike is quite a lot more predictable, because the last thing you want to do is go to a race and have something that you've never ridden before, and be trying to, you know, ride 100% on that, which is never a good idea. So it just takes basically the guesswork out of it, is to try and have a bike as consistent as you as you can.
Are you allowed sort of spare bikes, or like for once you're the bike you enter, is that the one you have to have for the championship? Because obviously I know in like Formula One, if you have gearbox changes and engine changes, you get penalised. Are there any rules like that in the Enduro GP?
No, we don't get penalised other than if you change certain parts actually during the race. I could race a completely new bike for Sweden once I finished Finland.
Right.
So during the year, we'll probably go through race bike wise, probably 3, 4, maybe 5 frames, maybe the same amount, maybe a couple more engines, because they'll kind of keep changing them and kind of checking on them and updating the pistons, and everything kind of has hours on it. You know, so you might do a frame and the perfect window for a certain frame might be between 20 and 60 hours, but then after that 60 hours that may become one of my training bikes. So it's kind of, you know, you try and keep the race bike in the perfect kind of window. But then during racing, the hubs of the wheels, the frame, the actual crank cases of the engine and the exhaust get paint marked or stickered. And those are the parts that you can't change. So you can change other things. But yeah, they're the fundamental parts that you can't change. And if you do, then you'll get disqualified.
And so obviously those, the hour time for the frames, is that just done over years of experience, knowing like when it's at its best and when it then sort of starts to taper off?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So you think like a steel frame, like what we use, some other manufacturers use aluminium. There'll be the first few hours of that frame, it'll be really stiff because everything's new, kind of welds and everything are new. So it's important to get maybe the first couple hours around, say, a motocross track or something where there's quite a lot of hard, harsh landings that can kind of help move the frame a little bit. And then it will kind of settle into its sweet spot for say 20, 30, 40 hours. And then after that, it, you know, with any kind of metal that gets stressed, it will eventually kind of deform over time. You know, and if you've got a frame that's 0 hours as opposed to 200, 300 hours, there'll be quite a big difference in how those two bikes will feel.
How often do you get sort of kit failures, like mechanical failures? Is that sort of fairly common? Because they take a hell of a beating, don't they, the bikes, for all conditions and weathers. Do you get many times where things just go wrong?
Touch wood, and I hope that I don't have anything go wrong in Sweden. I've been very, very fortunate to have not had. I had a couple early on, like my first year pro, but they were through kind of silly things. A couple of them kind of inflicted by hitting something. As far kind of mechanical failures, no, really. And even as far as like my training bikes, I've been extremely lucky to kind of keep everything intact. Although I did have one significant failure when I won the world championship in 2018. I actually blew my bike up on purpose, which is not great from a mechanical sympathy point of view, especially considering that bike won me a world championship. But
how did that come about?
I don't know, really. It's because I think I'd because when I won my first title in 2016, we in my contract, I get given the championship winning bike. So I have quite a collection of bikes at home at the moment. I basically got my 2016 bike brand new. So they kind of, you know, redone it back to how it would basically start the championship. So it's like new. The 2017 bike, I asked my mechanic to literally just clean it and give it to me as it's finished the race. So it's still got all the, like I was mentioning, the paint marks and everything on it. Still got used tires, used plastics, everything. For 2018, I was caught in the moment during celebrations. Always thought it would be good to blow up an engine, which, thinking back, probably wasn't the best and smartest idea. But it was quite cool to do that, and I was incredibly surprised how long the bike took really without any water and such to actually finally seize. But yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it was a good moment at the time.
What does your missus think of it all? Is she happy you doing it, or does she sort of cringing every time she sees you going rapid over jumps? And
yeah, she doesn't. I think certain times she doesn't like watching. So at the moment, she, because for the first 2 years that we were together, she came pretty much to every race with me. Whereas now she's at university studying to become a nurse, so she's quite full on with that at the moment. So she hasn't got chance to come to many races, but yeah, she's very supportive. But being a nurse, she's not overly supportive when I have injuries and issues. Although I can't really say that in how she kind of looked after me this winter with my after my operation. But yeah, she is very supportive, and that's a big part of kind of me and helping me, you know, kind of do what I can or do what I do.
Brilliant. Do you have sort of healthcare and stuff built in with the factory support?
No. So it's actually, it's a tricky one because you, everything kind of has to be done through myself. So if I want insurance, I have to go out and kind of find the insurance. And it's a tricky one because it's very expensive because you're a professional athlete. So I've always gone under the presumption of I'd save the money that I would basically charge for, or that be charged for the insurance, and kind of keep that into a pot on its side that, you know, if I do need an operation or something, then, you know, I've kind of got a pot of money there to do that. Exactly. So, and like I say, touch wood, it's worked well so far. So best thing is to try not to fall off, but it's never always that easy.
Obviously, on that note of injuries and fitness, Thea's got another quick question here.
Okay.
To fire across.
So obviously, going back to when you said your watch is quite important for you, do you have a special workout routine to get you nice and fit for the races?
I do indeed. So our season's broke down into a few different areas. So we have like what we call our pre-season, which is basically like before all the racing, where you try and get the most amount of volume of your work kind of done. So I'd say during pre-season we can be doing upwards of 12 14 16 hour weeks of kind of physical exercise, including riding, to kind of build your fitness levels going into the season, because the problem is when you start racing, it's very difficult to race, recover, continue to train and build fitness during the season. So we try to come in really kind of a really good shape, and then kind of race fitness will build throughout the races. But yeah, our days are taken up quite often by, you know, 1, 2, potentially always 3 training sessions a day. Riding tends to be more of my focus of like intensity, because whenever I ride the bike, I'm usually, you know, kind of pushing very high heart rates. And a lot of the stuff on the other side, kind of gym workout, running, cycling, rowing, is kind of a little bit lower intensity unless I've got some interval training.
Oh, sorry.
Like I say, that all the other training is basically to compensate and to kind of help me on the bike, really.
Also, one of the links that we're going to ask about, obviously with the fitness side of things, like diet and like any supplements, sort of recovery to help with that, you know, obviously anything for joints. I'd imagine your joints take sort of quite a hammering each round. Is there anything sort of you've got like as a bit of a ritual that you take to help with that?
I would say, it's kind of part and parcel with the job, really. I think it's not, if you're in it to try and be healthy and live a healthy life after racing, it's kind of probably not the best sport to be in. you get battered around quite a bit. So, but I think that's also one good thing about having a good fitness plan is you kind of, you know, bubble wrap yourself as much as you can. If you're strong and you've got strong joints and kind of, you know, muscles to help kind of protect you if you do fall. But I would say nutritionally, I try and get a lot of my supplements and vitamins through food, try and have a very healthy kind of balance, a balanced diet. But then I would say what I ritually take, so I'm pretty keen on just kind of like multivitamins. In winter, I take a good amount of vitamin D. And then there's certain things like lactic acid buffers that you can take, which kind of, you know, help when your muscles start to create lactic acid, it kind of buffers that threshold a little bit. But it's tricky to, because we have like drug controls, obviously you can't take, you know, anything. So you've got to be very particular in kind of where you get these, your products from, to make sure they're all batch tested and approved by kind of Informed Sport, which is the body that controls, controls these, to make sure there's no contaminants or, you know, you're using anything that's banned. So it's about trying to use things that are kind of clean and, you know, able to give you a little bit of a performance increase. But like I say, most of the stuff comes from food and making sure you take enough protein on board, really, to kind of recover, and carbohydrates to feed the muscles.
How often do you get tested?
We generally get a kind of urine test once during a season. So that's at a random world championship event. So they usually have 7 or 8 chances, because we usually have 7 or 8 rounds. But it's not always guaranteed that kind of you'll get chosen. I think I've had 3 or 4 drug tests over the last 8 seasons, and a couple all like breathalyzer tests. Actually, one of them was last weekend in Finland, just to make sure we hadn't taken any alcohol on board the night before, which is not great for performance.
So, it's not what you want, is it? Half cup.
No, exactly. Exactly. So safe to say I passed that one. But yeah, it's kind of, I think it's great that they do that, and there is kind of rules in place. And like I say, clean sport is definitely a good thing.
How much sort of work do you have to do for your sponsors to satisfy them? Because I imagine with social media and everything else, there's a fair bit on you to keep them happy, is there?
Yes. I mean, I'm quite fortunate that I have actually never been asked or told to improve or do something better than I am on social media. And considering I'm not as proactive as some riders in that aspect. I'm very much a little bit old school and can go multiple days without kind of going on social media and posting something. But it is great for me not only to kind of be in touch with my fans and the people that support me, and show some appreciation to them. But it's great for me to try and give back as much as I can to my kind of sponsors and the brands that I kind of work with. And like I say, if I'm usually free and open, if most times during the year there'll be kind of with each of my sponsors there'll be kind of certain photo shoots or video edits that they want to do. So there'll be, like I say, you know, a couple day trip here and there where I go to Italy, or there's usually a big event as well in the end of the season, like a big motorcycle show in Italy, and all the sponsors love kind of us going there and signing posters for the fans at the event. So like I say, I'm very open if they approach me and wanting to do anything. But just keeping up to date on social media and kind of keeping them keeping the product in the kind of public eye of my supporters, really.
I have noticed that, obviously, we've only been to a few events. We went to Helmsley last week, and then the last one standing this weekend, and it's from a spectator and a fan's perspective, it's everyone's very approachable, and they can almost touch them, can't they, when they go through some stages.
Exactly. It is like you say, a very approachable sport. And it's not as professional in terms of, you know, like you say, we're, you know, you can see us walking through the pits, you can, you know, like you say, practically be on the edge of the track as we ride past. So it is very unique in that area, where you know, you try and go to a motocross race or a car rally or you know, some road racing, it's much more difficult to kind of meet the athletes and kind of have a conversation and speak to them.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, we had Alex on as our first guest, and he's there with you now. Yeah. He does his like off-road experience days. So with the sport being, I suppose, it's a bit like any sort of elite sport, you've got a limited shelf life. I mean, I don't know what you do, if anything, or what are your plans sort of longer term when you retire from the pro team? What how do you see it moving forward from there?
I'm kind of hoping I have, I would say, another 4 seasons. So that would take me to 33 years old, which seems young, but in this sport there's there's always younger guys coming up behind you every year. And I think that would be nigh on, you know, 12 years kind of as a professional, which I think is you know, a very good career term. So like I say, all being well and providing I can stay healthy and motivated, that would kind of be my goal. I did always have aspirations of being a pilot in the RAF, but I think that boat has sailed, because I think there's definitely a cutoff in terms of how late you can apply to do that. And I think the travel away from home is already enough with what I'm doing now. But I have recently actually been quite intrigued about the police, joining the police. But yeah, I do need to have a look into that and kind of, basically kind of have a little bit more of a think. Definitely, I think when I would look to retire, I would hope there would be potentially some opportunities to stay within the sport, be it as a test rider, be it as a brand ambassador and in certain roles like this. So, it's kind of, I have some ideas and like I say, I've certainly reached that point where I've got less years ahead of me than what I have behind me, so it's always kind of good to think into the future, but like I say, I'm still a little bit early as to have a direct kind of idea of what I want to do, but it's definitely worth thinking about.
Okay, we're mindful of obviously taking up your time with you on such a tight schedule and the Sweden one coming up, so Theo, have you got any more questions you want to ask Steve? Are you happy?
No, I'm
passing. What about this one? Well, maybe we could ask this one, or I'll ask it. Do you want to ask that one?
I'll ask it.
Go on then.
Do you have any lucky charms?
Yeah, any lucky charms or any rituals or anything that you have, like, you know, must-haves before an event or anything you do in a particular order as a superstition?
I do actually. I have quite a lot. I have one particular lucky charm. It's quite... not embarrassing, but I had like a little stuffed kind of, not teddy, but it's like a dog. And you know, from the it's basically Top Dog, like like mimic on Top Gun, like Maverick and all that stuff. So I've got that, and that just lives in my kit bag, and it has done for basically since I turned pro. So that's quite a strange one that I don't actually think I've ever told anybody that, but so that's in there, that's out in the public eye now. But yeah, strange things like I've got to put my right glove on first, I've got to put my right knee brace on first, I always try and get on the bike from the left hand side, just little things like that. I've got this one song that I kind of, if I listen to before the race, I've always had really good races after listening to that song.
Can you share what song it is on that?
I think it's
not like S Club or something. Like that.
It's not quite that bad. I think it's Kungs and Crooks, Three Burners. I think that's the name of it. It's just a song that's neither good nor bad, but it's just a song that was kind of in one of my warm-up playlists, and it's basically another good luck charm. So that's pretty much it really.
You'll have to watch out for some of your rivals trying to steal your teddy then.
I know
your kit bag before the race.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I have to try and keep on top of that. I have to keep it with me personally at all times.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Okay, Steve, that's been brilliant. We'll wrap it there because we've been mindful of taking your time. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you very much. Thanks for the great questions.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
And you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.